assume that Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in free space in the cargo hold of the space shuttle. He's in weightlessness. Assume he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand, and assume that he weighs 200 pounds. He pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. His body responds by going 1 meter per second to the south. Action and reaction, equal, if the masses are equal. In case of forcing current into an antenna, there is an action and reaction. If you force 1 ampere of current into an antenna, whether you're feeding the center or the outer edge of an antenna, doesn't matter to some degree. You're forcing a current of 1 ampere into an antenna. You're standing on something called a counterpoise, and you've got to be drawing 1 ampere of current out of that counterpoise in order to be able to do that. And it doesn't have to be a balanced situation. If your counterpoise happens to be reactive, you could have a counterpoise of 10,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and an antenna with a load of 1,000 ohms. 10,000 ohms of capacitive reactance is the counterpoise impedance to space. 1,000 ohms is the impedance of the resistive component of your antenna to space. And now your transmitter is going to be launching current from the counterpoise into the antenna. The counterpoise is going to respond by having a voltage imposed onto it. It's going to be 10 times larger because the impedance is 10 times higher. So you might have 10,000 volts on the counterpoise and 1,000 volts into the antenna. And that can be an efficient system if the counterpoise is purely capacitive. It doesn't have to be balanced. You'd like it to be purely reactive if possible. So a purely reactive counterpoise, even if the impedance...
Repeater, timeout.
Even if the impedance is higher than the antenna, that can be an efficient system. You get an unbalance of voltages, but voltages that you launch into a capacitor are not lossy. One of the best puzzles I've given people periodically is I've got a 50-ohm signal generator. I've got a 50-ohm piece of coax cable. At the far end of the coax cable, I've got a shielded box. Inside the box is a variable capacitor. I'm running at 100 megacycles. I've carefully adjusted the capacitor to have a capacitor reactance of 50 ohms. So 50-ohm signal generator, 50-ohm coax cable, going into a shielded box with a 50-ohm capacitor reactance capacitor. I've adjusted the size of the capacitor so it is a 50-ohm load and it's a pure capacitor. And you ask people, what is the standing wave ratio of that system? A significant amount of electrical engineers will say it's 1-to-1. 50-ohm load, 50-ohm cable. I then ask them, okay, if it was a 50-ohm resistor in the box, the resistor would be getting hot with the energy coming out of the signal generator going down that transmission line. How much energy is being absorbed in that box? A pure capacitor cannot continuously absorb energy. It can absorb energy on the first half cycle. It gives it back on the second half of that cycle. A pure capacitor or a pure inductor does that. It cannot continuously absorb energy. Therefore, of all the energy going into that box, every bit of it is being reflected back. The standing wave ratio is not 1-to-1, it's infinity. You can't launch energy continuously into a pure reactant. Let me drop. But you can pour current into that pure reactant. So as a counterpoise, you're pouring current into a capacitive counterpoise. It's got capacitance to the universe, no resistance to the universe. You can pour current into it. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you can stand on that counterpoise and launch current into that antenna. You're getting a phase shift because it's a capacitor, but that's not bad. You're still launching current into the antenna. So an end-fed ZEP antenna, that Zeppelin, has got a certain amount of capacitance to the universe. You could be operating at 100 kc, where the wavelength is a mile, or a couple of miles, and your blimp is only a small fraction of a mile long. Nowhere near resonant, but you can still launch a beautiful signal into that end-fed ZEP because that Zeppelin has a certain amount of real capacitance in the universe, and so you can stand on it and launch current into the antenna. So the word counterpoise, everyone thinks it's got to be a zero-ohm resistor. A capacitive counterpoise is perfectly legal. You get a slight, you get a change in the apparent resonant frequency of your antenna when you're doing it that way. speed, you've now got a series circuit between signal generator, capacitance of your counterpoise, and the resistive or reactive impedance of your antenna. It's a great big series circuit of three objects. Let me drop. But the continuity of those circuits allows you to launch current into that antenna, and if the antenna is resonant and you're launching current into it at the right frequency, you're going to get a lot of circulating current. You're going to get a lot of magnetic fields and electric fields generated in the radiator, and you're going to radiate. And it can work with rather high efficiency. An NFED ZEP antenna, even though you've got the world's worst counterpoise, can be nearly 100% efficient. So you don't have to feed the antenna in the center. If you feed the antenna in the center, at one half cycle, you're drawing current out of the left side of the dipole and feeding it into the right side. There, the counterpoise on a full halfway dipole set in the center, your counterpoise is jumping back and forth between left side and right side, depending on which half cycle you're talking about. But if you decide to feed it at one end, it still works if you're smart enough in setting up the right impedance matching network, even though it's non-traditional. So maybe that helps a little bit, Wes. You can be in the top of... Let me drop... You can be in the top of a very tall building, and if you're feeding a symmetric antenna like a dipole, no problem. By the way, an astronaut floating in free space, where he's got a dipole, half the dipole goes to the north away from his spacesuit, half the dipole goes to the south away from his spacesuit, he's sitting in the middle with a signal generator. The local ground is hundreds of miles below him. People think an antenna only works if you've got a near local ground to operate against. Absolutely not. A dipole in free space will work like a charm, even though you're really in free space, a zillion miles away from the Earth. You're simply launching current from one half of the dipole to the other half, and the transmitter is sitting in the middle. In the early days of ham radio, a lot of hams would operate from the attic of a wooden house on the third floor. Half the dipole went out the north window, half the dipole went out the south window of the attic, and the transmitter sat on a wooden table in the middle between the two. Worked like a charm. When the ham shack got moved to the basement, now you needed a transmission line that went from the attic down to the basement. An open wire line could do that. So, how you launch current into the antenna is your choice. It doesn't necessarily require a local ground or a clearly defined counterpoise to do that. But if you're feeding the outer impedance of a very high impedance antenna, an extremely minor, maybe capacitive, counterpoise can do the job. As long as you can launch current into that antenna from the place you're standing on, you can make it work. Maybe that helps a little bit, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you for that. First, I have a problem with some of the comments. And it is about pumping energy into the capacitive reactance. If you have a capacitor, the amount of energy temporarily stored by the capacitor is based on its physical the diameters of the plate. And we're talking about millihenry, microhenry, the supercapacitors. The amount of energy that could be stored. Not only that you're dealing with half of a cycle. Let me drop.
Yeah, let me stop you on that one. If at an RF frequency, I'm feeding voltage into a pure capacitor, at the positive peak of voltage into that capacitor, the amount of energy I store in joules is 1/2 CV squared. Capacitance in farads, voltage in volts, 1/2 CV squared, that's the amount of joules of energy I store in the capacitor on the positive half cycle. On the negative half cycle, I take all of the energy back out. So at RF frequencies, the energy you put into a capacitor on 1/2 cycle, you get every bit of it back on the next half cycle. No continuous amount of energy is flowing to the capacitor, assuming the capacitor doesn't have any series resistance. So a pure reactance, inductance or capacitor, you can put energy into it on each half cycle, but you get it back on the next half cycle. So you're still going to get an infinite standing wave ratio. You're going to get a phase shift of the energy that's reflected. The standing wave ratio is going to give you a phase shift, but you're still going to get all 100% of the energy back into that transmission line, therefore a nearly infinite standing wave ratio. And it's a tricky question. N2XJN, wait for the beeps, K2LIW.
You're right, it's a tricky question, because when we're dealing with a square wave or rectangular wave signals, and then the capacity of the capacitor plays the major role of amount of energy in that half of a cycle, especially when we have a DC offset in it. Back to you.
Yeah, it turns out that using a square wave, which is really by Fourier series, a number of individual frequencies, all the odd frequencies, if it's a symmetric square wave, each of those individual frequencies, you're putting energy in one half of the cycle and taking it back out. So whether you feed a square wave or a sine wave into a pure capacitor, and you do it for many cycles, the average amount of energy flow that's being absorbed by the capacitor is zero. It's reflecting it all back to you on each half cycle. I know that doesn't make common sense at first. There was a person who wanted to make a comment. Please give us your call letters and your name, and then your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I think I doubled. WS2N, Paul. Take the other station. I think I doubled there.
Roger. Who is that other station?
This is KD2INX.
KD2INX, India November X-ray. Start up your name, sir, and then your comment or question.
No comment or question. I just wanted to say Happy New Year to you. And this is KD2INX.
Okay, thank you. Paul, WS2N, go ahead with your question or comment, Paul.
Before that, the counterpoise has to be half lambda, bigger than half a lambda. So how do you manage that in situations when you are at high elevation, especially in the plane and trickshare?
A conventional counterpoise is half a wavelength long or a quarter wavelength long. In the case of feeding the right side of the dipole from the left side of the dipole, each half of the dipole is a quarter wavelength long, and that's a conventional counterpoise. If I feed the dipole not at the center, but halfway between center and the outer edge, now the left side of the dipole is an eighth wavelength long, the right side of the dipole is 3/8 of a wavelength long, and as long as I've got the right kind of a balanced signal generator at that location, I can feed all of my energy into that dipole. There's nothing magic about feeding it from the center. There's nothing magic about the counterpoise being identical in impedance to the antenna itself. They can be very unbalanced. So when you're feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance outer edge of a half-wave dipole, I can be using an extremely high impedance counterpoise and still make it work, and still make it work with reasonably high efficiency. So conventional counterpoise, yes. The counterpoise doesn't have to always match convention. Ain't that crazy? Let's see what Paul's got to say on all this. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
I thought you were finished with Wesley, so I have a different question. So if you want to continue on, let me know.
Yeah, Wesley has gotten a fraction of the information he's looking for. Go ahead with your question, Paul.
Very good. Question with trying to cut back on the amount of wires I have here. Like most of us, I got more things plugged in than I can possibly imagine. Trying to cut back on some of the wires, and as I was doing it, it dawned on me, I have all these surge protectors that are plugged in. Do you think there's anything wrong with plugging a surge protector into another surge protector, you know, instead of just running a completely different three-prong wire, you know, for that matter, a third one? I mean, is there any, do you stop the function of the first one by doing that, or wonder if there's any kind of a problem? Back to you, Dick.
Now, the surge protectors, I'm not quite sure, are you using them in parallel, in series? Why are you using multiple surge protectors connected to each other? run that by a little slower, Paul, because I seem to have missed something. Are they being used in parallel or in series, and why?
I have three of them, and some of them have short pigtails coming off of it, so, you know, I'll run a extension cord, you know, to plug that one in. Why can't I just take, you know, one surge protector with, you know, half a dozen outlets in it, plug another one in series, you know, plug one into that one, and now I have, instead of, say, five outlets, now I've got, like, nine outlets, and plug another one into that, and, you know, I would do three at the most. I have a lot of things that plug in here, all kinds of equipment, so, you know, it adds up, so... That's the question. I'm wondering if the function of the of this whole setup would be, you know, would still be operable. Or, you know, am I doing something where I'm knocking out the effect of the surge protector in case there was a problem?
Very good. Now I got a much better picture. That second plug-in surge protector into the first is giving you twice as much protection. The third one plugged into the second one is giving you three times as much protection as far as surge protection is concerned. However, you've now got to worry about the individual current ratings. The plug that you're using on the first outlet, each one of those outlets is rated for a certain number of amperes, and as you start cascading things, you're going to start exceeding that real fast. So do you have a safe system as far as current drain on individual outlets when everything is turned on? You've got to be a little bit slow on that one. And so you might be better off, instead of cascading them three in a row, plug two separate surge protectors into two separate outlets of the first surge protected multi-output. That might be a better, safer way of doing things current-wise, and more than safe enough as far as surge protecting is concerned. And when it comes to surge protecting, let me drop it. Many of these surge protectors contain an MOV device, metal oxide varistor, I think it's called. And that metal oxide varistor can only take one or two shots, something like that, before it degrades. So if a lightning burst occurred in your neighborhood and your surge protector of an MOV type protected you for that particular lightning strike, it doesn't necessarily mean you're still protected for the next one. I think they become damaged on each individual strike. So that's something to worry about. And how you rate whether or not the MOV is still operative, I don't know. And so proper household wiring as far as maximum current, fire protection, surge protection, and grounding is concerned, oh, there's a whole lot of rules, regulations, and wives' tales on how to properly do that. Very few of us do it right. I've got a whole lot of octopus wiring in my house that I know is unsafe. And from time to time, I have nightmares about what could happen in the worst case. So when you've got them cascaded, though, in series, the second and third guy downrange doesn't have less surge protection. He's got more. In order for that spike of voltage to get to that third stage, it's got to get through the other two stages, and so there's at least three different places where it's going to be cut down and limited as to the magnitude of that spike. So your third piece of electronics, as long as it's not drawing too much current from that particular path, is now triply protected as I see it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. There was somebody who tried to say something to us who was 95% noise, 5% audio. We didn't get any of that audio. You got it, Paul, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I must have 14 to 15 different things plugged in. So, very good. I just wanted to check on that. So, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And I'll keep the wattage, you know. These things are rated at 1,500 watts. So, I mean, I don't have that kind of wattage. It's not like I'm running an external amp for the HF rig. Most I run is 100 watts on that, so that takes out about 200 watts or so on the power supply, and then the rest of the other stuff is all low voltage stuff, you know, HTs, clocks and fans and couple of lights and, you know, weather radios that goes on and on. Very good, Dick. Back to you, WS2N.
And to you.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I have a comment on electronic schools if and when you get a chance.
Yeah, one final crazy example I'm going to give with a so-called NFED ZIP antenna. We have seen occasionally diagrams in our QST magazine and other places where somebody has taken an open wire transmission line. One side of the open wire transmission line feeds an NFED ZIP antenna, a somewhat random length of wire, and he's feeding the outer end of it. The other side of the open wire transmission line goes nowhere. And your first question is going to be, where the hell is the counterpoise in that situation? That 600 ohm open wire line at the tail end of it, one lead is going to a wire that we call radiator or antenna, and the other lead goes nowhere. Can that work? The answer is yes, but there's a catch. A great big voltage appears, of course, the output end of that 600 ohm open wire line, transmission line, in my example. The wire that goes nowhere is now launching a huge amount of voltage and current that goes back down the outside of the open wire line. It's an unbalanced current. And now the length of that wire back to the shack and the grounding of the shack becomes a inductive or capacitive resonator, and you're lighting up the whole transmission line. At first it sounds impractical, depending on the length of the transmission line and the exact impedance at that frequency for the random length wire antenna, that system can work. It may not work well. You may have a fair amount of RF in the shack, but there the schematic diagram would lead you to believe there is no counterpoise at all. One of the two leads of the output of the transmission line looks like...
Repeater, timeout.
One of those two leads of the output of that open wire transmission line looks like it's going nowhere. It really is going nowhere as far as the schematics is concerned. But your open wire transmission line, normally you feed it in the pure differential manner. At one instant of time, you put plus 100 volts on the right side and minus 100 volts on the left side. That's a purely symmetric feeding system. You don't have to always feed it symmetrically. One of the things that K2KNB was doing, Mel, was occasionally feeding his open wire transmission line in the collective manner, not the differential manner. You could, if you want to, put plus 100 volts on the right-hand side and plus 100 volts on the left-hand side of the open wire transmission line at this instant of time. On the next half cycle, minus 100 volts on both sides. You're now feeding it not differentially, you're feeding it collectively. It's still a good transmission line. It's got a spooky impedance when you feed it that way, but you're feeding a signal down there which will get to your antenna. Okay? When it comes to this crazy NFED ZIP example I just gave you before, where you're using a differential feed of the transmission line in the shack, but when it gets to this unbalanced antenna, all of a sudden, you're at that point now launching a collective signal that goes back down the outside, so to speak, of that open wire transmission line. In the case of open wire transmission line, it's a little bit spooky to talk about the internal impedance and the external impedance. Let me drop this. In the case of a coax cable, the internal impedance between the semiconductor and the inside end, inside layer of the shield, we know about that. And if you do something wrong at the tail end of that coax cable, you can start launching currents down the outside of the coax cable, like feeding an NFED ZIP with only the semiconductor. And now you're launching currents down the outside. There's now a collective current as well as a differential current. Well, the fact that you can do that on coax, which is one kind of transmission line, there's nothing stopping you from doing that with open wire line. You can create an imbalance on the output end of an open wire line, and now what you're doing is you're launching a common mode current going back down that line. you think that the open, you think that the current is only flowing down the open-ended piece of wire of the open wire transmission line. It's really flowing down both of them. So there is internal impedance, which is the differential impedance of an open wire line, and there is an external impedance, which is the so-called collective impedance. And you, with enough smarts, you can decide which one you can feed and how much by changing the length of that line, that open wire transmission line, which hopefully is coming back to a virtual ground at your balancing device. On the output of your transmitter, you've got some kind of a balancing device, a balancing device that's launching signal into your open wire transmission line. And usually there's some kind of an internal ground to that balancing device. And now, depending on the length of your open wire line, which is really a certain number of wavelengths between that ground and the output end of your open wire line, you can get funny resonances as far as the common mode impedance is concerned. And you can make all of that work. And there's ways of studying it. And it's not black magic. And so the feeding of an end...
Repeater, time out.
The feeding of an NSAID ZEP antenna at times is very spooky. But this is all related to that earlier question that Barry was asking. On 160 meters, can I feed a 160 meter antenna from my mobile and make it efficient? And the answer is yes. If you make that resonator half-wave resonance on the top of your car, connect it to your car, if the resonator is half-wave, which could give you a very high feed impedance, at least 10,000 ohms in some cases, can you feed that from your automobile? Absolutely. And you might be able to feed that a lot more efficiently than the way people are normally feeding it. Making something a half-wave resonant electronically at 160 meters, it's a serious challenge, but it is definitely doable. Anybody got any further questions and comments on all of the above? There's only an infinite number of ways of making an antenna, and in my opinion, there's only 5,000 kinds of recognized antennas right now. KQRAW listening.
Understand. Oh, size. Size of the plate stands for its capacitive reactance. Of course, the capacitive reactance at its maximum could never be reached, as it is directly dependent on the height of the half of the cycle. But my question is, again, that doesn't have to be more than half of lambda of the contact point size, but how the size of the capacitive plate that's supposed to interact with the earth is being applied towards the impedance match of an antenna to achieve.
Many people think that every antenna works by feeding some kind of a signal with reference to Earth. Not always true. My astronaut could be floating in space, in his spacesuit, a mile behind the space shuttle, 200 miles above the Earth. And in his hand is a half-wave dipole with a transmitter in the middle of the half-wave dipole. That's a beautifully efficient antenna. Where's the counterpoise in that situation? And where's the ground? Doesn't need a ground. All you have to do to launch a radio signal is to pour energy into the resonator function of the thing that you call radiator. As long as you can pour energy into that radiator at its resonant frequency, you can get nearly 100% efficiency of radiation. So as long as you can launch energy into your resonator, you can do that. Now, could that astronaut not feed a half-wave dipole in the center? Could he feed the outer edge of it? Absolutely. His body would become the counterpoise. At the frequency he's operating at, his body may be a 30th of a wavelength long, head to toe. But his body has a certain amount of capacitance to the rest of this universe. His body's capacitance to the rest of the universe might be 5 picofarads. And can he put a transmitter between that 5 picofarad capacitor to the rest of the universe? It might have a capacitor reactance of 10,000 ohms. Can he launch a signal between his suit and the NSAID ZEP that's sitting in front of him. Absolutely. The total impedance, he's going to see 10,000 ohms of capacitor reactance into the universe, plus maybe the...
Repeater, time out.
Plus maybe the 10,000 ohms of resistive impedance of his NFED ZEP. Therefore, his transmitter is going to see a total impedance, in my example, of 10,000 ohms of capacitance in series with 10,000 ohms of resistance. Can he possibly make an impedance match to that with the Berkeley program? Absolutely. Easy. So as long as you have any amount of capacitance of the thing that you call counterpoise, and it's got some amount of capacitance to the rest of the universe, some of it's the rest of the universe, some of it's the Earth that's below him by 200 miles. Doesn't matter. He's got a certain amount of capacitance. Can he use it as a counterpoise to launch signal into that NFED ZIP antenna in front of him? Absolutely. It may not be easy, but with the right kind of an impedance matching network, he can do it. His body does not have to be a quarter wavelength long. It's only got to have enough size to have a measurable amount of capacitance to the rest of the universe, and he can then use it as the counterpoise to launch current and voltage and signal into that resonant antenna. Ain't that crazy yet, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it is an excellent answer. However, I'm kind of confused by you. Are you trying to say that my long plate of capacitors in square will only be loaded to reach intended capacitive reactance based on the amount of voltage of the half of a cycle? Because obviously counterpoise must resonate. So its physical properties must be suitable for to serve as a balance, counterbalance, and to exceed.
In the case of feeding a dipole in the center, and it's a half-wave dipole, you see something like 73 ohms of impedance, resistive. There's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. You can feed it halfway between center, 90% between center and the tip, or out of the outer tip. Feed it anywhere you want, as long as you can launch energy into it. You get very different impedances when you do that, but because of the action and reaction, Newton's third law equivalent of electronics, you've got to be standing on something that we call counterpoise to launch a signal into your NFED antenna. But you could be standing on a very high impedance. Just a minor amount of capacitance to the universe is a good enough counterpoise that you can launch a signal into. You're going to have a very high total impedance. In my example before, 10,000 ohms of capacitor reactance of his spacesuit to the universe and 10,000 ohms of resistive impedance of his NFED ZIP means that the transmitter is now going to see a total impedance of 10,000 ohms of capacitor reactance in series with 10,000 ohms of resistance. And can you make an impedance matching network to do that? Absolutely. So only if your counterpoise has zero capacitance and an infinite amount of inductance and infinite amount of resistance. If your counterpoise is a dot, which is the ink dot on a page, and if you want to use that as a counterpoise, I think it's not going to work. However, you've got a transmitter in your hand that's trying to launch a signal into the antenna. The transmitter is in some kind of a metal case. Let me drop it. That metal case of the transmitter has a certain amount of physical size. It's got a certain amount of surface area. The case of that transmitter has some number of picofarads of capacitance to the rest of the local universe, if it's sitting on your table, or if you're floating in free space, it's got a certain amount of capacitance to free space. So the transmitter case itself can be the counterpoise that allows you to launch a signal into an NFED ZIP. So only if your transmitter was micro-miniature, the size of the dot on the page, now you might not be able to launch a signal into your NFED ZIP. But our transmitters are not that compact. The metal case of the transmitter can serve as a counterpoise. Ain't that crazy? and 2XJN, K2LAW in the TechNet.
When you have a cell phone, there is a microprocessor that works to compensate the increase of capacity of reactance when you take it to the handle you light on the table, and that's how the antenna keeps its resonant properties. However, if we talk about the handy-talking, the first one from 20 years ago, there was no such thing. And I wonder how much of body influence was detuning or detuning the antenna feeding that particular transmitting frequency performance. And to actually,
in the case of handy-talkie antennas, handy-talkie transmitters, on say for instance 6 meters, 2 meters, 450, the case is much too small to be a good counterpoise. The hand of the human being holding onto that case is part of the counterpoise. There's a significant amount of capacitance between your hand and the rest of your arm and the rest of your body to feed signal into that rubber duck. And in the early days, that rubber duck was made out of nichrome wire in order to make it broadband. They made it a little bit lossy so it'd get a better impedance match. Many rubber duck antenna systems on handy talkies are feeding some pretty spooky impedances. And the manufacturer had to work pretty hard to find some kind of a compromise of the way he made the impedance matching network inside of that handy talkie feed that rubber duck. But the case of the transmitter itself is the counterpoise. And yes, most of our cell phones do have an impedance matching network, an antenna tuner built into the cell phone, because the antenna that's inside that cell phone is much too small for many of those frequencies and many of those frequency regions. Let me drop them. Many of those frequency regions that the antenna that the cell phone has to operate over. But an antenna only works well when it's resonant. You resonate first, then it will radiate. Therefore, the cell phone manufacturer has put an antenna tuning integrated circuit chip very close to that antenna, inside of that cell phone, that adjusts the impedance depending on what frequency and what part of the band you're on. And he does that for the average situation of that cell phone being held into a human hand against the human head. And so it becomes a bit of a compromise if you lay the cell phone on the table and the human being is not nearby. The efficiency of that antenna could get much lower as far as impedance matching is concerned. But it could get higher because of the local environment. Of all the signal radiated by your cell phone, a certain percentage of it goes into the water of your head, gets absorbed by the water of your head, and turned into heat. A certain amount of radiation of that cell phone, with perfect impedance matching, is going into heat of your head, not very many of it, not many or many milliwatts, it's not dangerous. Stop worrying, let me drop it. The total radiated power, when it's held against your head, I don't know the exact number, but if I had to make a guess, I'm going to guess that 25% of the power radiated by that cell phone is absorbed by your head, turned into heat, and it's lost forever. You take that cell phone and lay it on the wooden table. The impedance match got worse, and now the cell phone went down 25% in efficiency between its transmitter and its antenna. That's if the antenna tuner is not the adaptive kind. Some of them are adaptive. Just like you've got an automatic antenna tuner for your transmitter, for your ham rig, there are automatic antenna tuners for some cell phones. So it might be readjusting itself when you put it on that table. But because the human head is not nearby of the signal, it does radiate. That 25% that used to be absorbed by your head is not being radiated. The efficiency, when it's laid down on the table, could increase, even though there's an additional impedance mismatch, if it's not the adaptive type. On top of that, when it comes to a well-designed cell phone system, let me drop it. The number of miles between you and that local cell site and the amount of power your transmitter in its adaptive mode, the transmitter in your cell phone is going up and down in power. It's being continuously commanded a number of times per second by the cell site. Go up, go down, because the signal is going into a fade as you move around the room. It's an adaptive system. It's a the word I'm looking for is simply adaptive. And that adaptive system may have 10 or 15 dB of margin In other words, if you go behind a metal wall in the men's room and you're still operating your cell phone, the system is able to go 10 times higher in power output in order to compensate. So because of the adaptive capability of the system, the individual efficiencies of what's in the environment of the cell phone antenna and what impedance matching it's getting and whether or not it's running out of range of its automatic antenna tuner, all of that is continuously going up and down and being balanced so that the base station tries to keep the signal a certain number of dB above threshold so that they're able to reuse that frequency 3 cell sites downrange from where you are. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, to actually, efficiency. In philosophical terms, modern HMH penis to perform despite its size. By that, those are famous words, and by that, you have a very small, tiny antenna. The roll of the wire that is sufficient to serve as a resonating circuit, and that's your antenna. And then you have a big antenna, huge one, and it's an antenna. Would you please say a few words about the efficiency and differences of the efficiency between two of them, and to actually end?
Okay, one of the best examples I've used on this one, Wes, in the past, is that I'm building an 80-meter dipole at a 14-gauge wire. I'm mounting it 40 feet in the air, parallel to the ground, in my backyard. A 132-foot-long piece of wire, fit in the center, 14-gauge wire, 80 meters, good half-wave antenna. I now move to another piece of property, where my antenna can no longer be 132 feet long. It can only be 32 feet long. Instead of being a half-wavelength long, it's now 8th wave, 16th of a wave. And I re-resonate that antenna by helical winding, by loading coils, inductors, by top hat capacitors. I make it a resonant antenna at a low loss materials, but it's physically only 132 feet long. Your first question is, will the 132-foot antenna, one quarter of the size of the full, 132 feet is the full size, 32 feet is the small size on my new piece of property, can I still get nearly 100% efficiency? Answer is absolutely yes. If the low-loss materials are not giving me a lot of resistive loss in the antenna, I've now got a much higher Q antenna. There's a much more circulating current. I've got to work harder to make sure the antenna doesn't become lossy. But if I mount it at the exact same altitude, the shorter antenna, I put 100 watts into the full-size antenna, I get a certain amount of signal strength to London. I put 100 watts into a 32-foot antenna, I can get almost the same signal strength into London. I can get almost the exact same efficiency on transmit. Okay, next question is, what happens to the receiver area? The receiver area can be almost the same. The electronic area, the magic of resonance, the shorter antenna is running higher.
Repeater, timeout.
The shorter antenna is running much higher in Q. Therefore, its electronic area is much bigger than its physical area. The full half-wave dipole has 8,500 square feet of real radio area. If my eyes operated at 80 meters, I'd see this great big black oval in space, about 150 feet wide, about 30 feet high. It would be 8,500 square feet. The full-size half-wave dipole. The infinitesimal dipole never loses more than half a dB of apparent gain. And the half a dB is not real loss. It's slightly broader figure-eight antenna pattern because there's less wavelengths of the antenna. The beam width is a little bit broader. The donut is a little bit fatter, the three-dimensional donut of antenna pattern. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it's got 8,300 square feet, so to speak. Even though it's physically smaller, that's the magic of resonance. It's going to be very high in Q. If I QSY 5KC, I've got to retune everything. It's going to be a very narrow band antenna, very high in Q. But the magic of the higher Q means that it's got more area to it. Very similar to what happens with pushing my daughter on the swing. Let me drop it. If she's a very aerodynamic shape, so she's not creating very much wind resistance, and if I've got a very efficient set of ball bearings at the top of the swing, I can now use my pinky to push on her. I can do only a fraction of an ounce of push on each cycle, but if I do it for enough cycles, I will still build up the full deflection of her swinging on that swing. I can still build up the same amount of energy. It takes longer for me to do it because it's a higher Q system, so to speak, and I'm using less energy, less forcing energy, but I can still get the same amount of energy into that system. Very similar to what's happening with this infinitesimal dipole. It's got a very high Q. The rise time and fall time of the signal going into that dipole is going to be longer. But the rise time of a dipole is some number of microseconds. Compared to the milliseconds of audio I plug into it, I don't even see that rise time, if you know what I mean. So, can the shorter, smaller dipole have almost the same efficiency? Yes. Almost the same gain? Yes. Opposite of common sense. You say these words on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, and 95% of the guys will say, you're absolutely crazy. That infinitesimal dipole is going to have the same amount of radio area? Can't happen. Well, those that 8,500 square feet of area works beautifully, even though the power lines are at the exact same altitude in front of my house, because the power lines are not resonant. They create a shadow of only a couple of square feet under my 8,500 square feet. As long as those power lines are not resonant, I won't even know they're there. N2XJN, KQRIW.
Excellent answer. The only addition that I have to it is, you explain how you build the energy in the swing. You didn't explain the very nature of that energy delivered. The very nature of energy delivered is compensation of its loss. The closer you are to the resonant, its very own resonant frequency of the swing, with the load on it or the weight of your daughter on it, the less of energy is required to keep the full swing, and that energy would be always compensation of the loss. And to extreme.
Yeah, if I'm only pushing her with my pinky and a fraction of an ounce on each push, I've got to carefully time each one of my pushes. I better be doing it at the resonant frequency. But if I do it at the resonant frequency, I can build up the same amount of deflection. It's going to take me longer to do it. So, the infinitesimal dipole and the very efficient swing, where I'm giving very little push, there's a strong relationship between the two. And so the total amount of energy, in both cases, can be the same. The total amount of effective radio area can be the same. There is a chapter in the first edition of Krauss's book called Antennas, on the so-called infinitesimal dipole. You never lose more than half a dB of apparent gain when you go from a full half-wave dipole down to an infinitesimal dipole, as long as you're using low-loss materials and you electronically force it into resonance, you'll get the same performance. So that tiny little antenna that's inside of your cell phone, which is much too small to be a good resonant quarter-wave or half-wave antenna, with that impedance-matching device, the antenna tuner that's in there, the loading coils and everything else, as long as they can force it into resonance, and as long as they keep all the nearby material in that cell phone low in RF loss, all of the individual stages, let me drop, near that antenna, all of the nearby radio stages are inside of shielded metal cans. If they weren't, the local magnetic field, the local radiation from that antenna, would be absorbed by the local resistors and integrated circuits and whatever. In order to keep that antenna efficient, when it's so darn small in electronic size, they make sure all of the lossy materials nearby are inside of shielded cans. So now the energy radiated by the antenna, all it can do is reflect off those shielded cans and be radiated into space. The next question is, does that change the antenna pattern? And the answer is almost no, because all of those little bitty shielded cans are so small in wavelength, they are not changing the antenna pattern. In order for you to derive a significant antenna pattern from a radiating system, you have to use real estate. There's got to be some number of half wavelengths of size of your radiating and reflecting system in order to affect the antenna pattern. If all of your radiating, if all of your reflecting, let me drop it. If all of your reflecting little metal cans inside of that cell phone are each a wavelength, an eighth of a wavelength in diameter, they have almost no effect on the antenna pattern. Because the whole radiating system inside that cell phone is so electronically small, the antenna pattern of it is very close to isotropic. When you plot the three-dimensional antenna pattern of a cell phone by using a Satomo machine, which does that three-dimensional plot for you, it looks like what I call an apple plot. It's a great big round red thing with a couple of dimples in one side where the stem of the apple would go. You've got a couple of gnarls in one or two sides of the apple, but the majority of the area is essentially isotropic. Therefore, a certain amount of the energy radiated by that antenna is going into your head. That's a quarter of an inch away when you hold that cell phone into your head. And your head, as far as radio is concerned, is a great big bag of water, because there's a lot more water in you than anything else. And water at ultra high frequencies is an extremely good dummy load. So a quarter of an inch away from your cell phone, there's some local heating taking place by that RF energy that hits your head. Anybody with any further questions or comments of all the above, don't let this stuff scare you. K2LIW listening.
Yeah, the only addition that you could make is that you answer why telephone companies make repeaters or cells not more than 1 mile radius from your cell phone antenna is because of limited size of the antenna of the cell phones versus the power of no more than 50 milliwatts that's supposed to be used. However, I believe the first cell phones were in range of 1 watt of RF power. Back to you.
The locations of the cell sites are closely packed because you've got a lot of lossy materials. Buildings, water towers, trees, forests, hills. You get a lot of lossy materials nearby. People. So there's a lot of attenuation between you and that cell site. The size of the antenna inside of your cell phone is not a factor. Even if they gave you the full-size whip antenna you used to have coming out of the cell phone, it's only a quarter of a wavelength long. A quarter of a wavelength long antenna as a whip outside of your cell phone versus a 16th of a wavelength antenna inside. Those two antennas have almost the identical antenna pattern. It takes multiple half wavelengths of antenna, like a base station antenna, like a super station master. It takes multiple half wavelengths to develop a real antenna pattern. If all of the components of your antenna are half wavelengths and less, you've got a nearly isotropic antenna no matter what you do. And if you're smart enough to make the antenna out of low loss materials, they've all got the same efficiency. Let me drop. So the reason the cell sites are packed close together is because of the losses they have to accommodate, and because of the limited power that's being radiated by the 50 or 100 milliwatts of limitation. Because we rate the specific absorption rate of each of the cell phones, and we want to keep it below, I think the number is 2 watts per kilogram, I think it is the number in the United States. So we limit the transmit power. The size of the antenna and the efficiency of the antenna is almost not a factor. The lossy materials between your cell site and your cell phone is the reason they're packed in tight. So the size of the antenna is not a factor. Ain't that crazy? Because the infinitesimal dipole has the exact same gain and almost the exact same antenna pattern. N2XJN for any further comments on this. K2LIW and the TechNet.
Comment, KE2FIU.
Go ahead.
You've got it, George.
I just jumped back in about 10 minutes ago, but I'm realizing there's something here, and hopefully you guys realize this, that the switching protocol, when a cell phone is up, contains a lot of information with the device. including controlling the output power of the device, so that the device may be at lower power, medium power, high power, anything in between, so that the antenna matching can also be controlled. It's not a fixed homing that's happening between your phone and the antenna, the cell phone antenna location. You're actually being controlled. Your phone is actually being controlled by how much power it's going to put out. KD2FIU.
Yeah, that's true, George. I don't know the exact number, but something like 20 times per second, the cell site is telling your cell phone, go up or go down in power output. As you move around the room, and you're going into selective phase, if you are listening to what's coming out of your local repeater and a receiver that's across the room, as you take your handy talkie and walk around the room and twist it and raise it and lower it and push it out and in and whatever, the actual signal getting to your repeater is going up and down. The cell site is compensating for that. It is 20 times per second telling your cell phone to go up or down in order to keep the power being received to be a constant signal-to-noise ratio. Maybe they're aiming for a plus 15 dB carrier-to-noise ratio. I don't know the exact number. So you're continuously being ordered. It's an adaptive system that adapts to you walking around so as to not getting a fade and not be using up extra battery power, if you know what I mean. And the system also, in most cases, is using a kind of triangulation as well as trilateration. It's also figuring out where you are located because it is using phased array antenna techniques to steer the beam from the cell site to your antenna, to your cell phone, both on transmit and receive. It's adjusting its antenna pattern to favor your particular direction. So in order to make the whole system thoroughly adaptive and efficient, all of that communication back and forth is going on continuously. This is what I think you're telling us, George. Over to you, George. KD2FIU, K2LIW in the tech net.
Thank you, Dick, K2RIW, KD2FIU. And it's more than just the user's signal power and distance away. It's also the other interference that the cell phone tower is receiving. I'll let that go with that. Just something to interject as it's going on. It's a little bit more complex than what we see from the HT to a repeater. KD2FIU.
Yeah, that also makes sense. It's continuously adjusting. It is continuously measuring the bit error rate of the signal it's getting from your cell phone. And so if a source of interference comes along on your frequency, it will tell your cell phone to go up in power or to switch to another frequency to compensate for all that. They're trying to control the bit error rate, call it carrier to noise ratio, that cell site receives from you and that you receive from the cell site. I think the cell phone has also got the equivalent of a signal strength meter telling the cell site how much signal the cell phone is getting, and therefore the cell site itself is going up and down in power output. It transmits in your direction. It's an extremely adaptive system. A lot of busy signals are going back and forth. We've gone way beyond the point when we should have gone over to the space report. So here comes space report number 235, Alpha. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you for getting about me.
Now, we've gone way beyond the time. We're going to have to put you off till next week, Rich. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N. And okay, a couple of main stories. Definitely the EVA that started last Friday, they did another one this Friday. So Shane Kimbrough went out with French ESA astronaut, Thomas Piquet, and he, both of them were out about 6 hours.